the disruption to journalism in the next 20 years will likely be greater than we've seen in the last 20. So what might it look like? The Future of Journalism series attempts to paint that picture. I'm Peter Wilkinson with the Alliance for Journalist Freedom in Australia, and we say it's flawed planning to make decisions about a future if we don't know where we're heading. To create legislation and issue court decisions and to encourage journalists on a career path, if we don't have a good idea of what tomorrow's journalism will or should look like. Alan Soon is co-founder of Splice Media in Singapore and behind a lot of the news revolution across Southeast Asia. Splice Media helps media startups through events, consulting, training, and more. And as a leading thinker in our region on the future of media, Soon predicts the further decline of the major publishers and an emergence of more niche publications, and explains here why he is also against the ACCC's move in Australia to force Google and Facebook to pay publishers for their content. Alan Soon, let's start by going backwards, looking forwards. You said to me a few days ago when we were preparing for this that you, a decade ago, had predicted many of the things that have now come to pass. Would you like to explain that?
We have basically seen this transformation of the space taking a whole decade in which large media, mass media companies have been disintegrating into smaller little chunks. One of the obvious things even back then, 10 years ago, was that the digital audience was going to be a niche audience. It was never going to be, you know, a big mass media kind of audience where you could create one product for everybody that was out there. Digital is a complete opposite. The internet is a complete opposite. The internet favors anything that's niche, anything that is community-based, that is focused on one specific interest group. So the internet has given rise to a number of media startups in that space just because it is cheap to start something on your own. It is easy to target the kind of people that you're looking for. It's easy to deliver content to an audience almost for free in many of these cases. So, you know, back then, 10 years ago, it was clear that the large mass media model would not fit into this digital world that we're heading into.
So would you now like to look forward another 10 years and make another prediction of where we're going to be at the end of this decade?
Yeah, I think this continuation will continue. If you look at what COVID has done for all of us this year, is basically fast forwarding this entire process of digital transformation, probably by about 5 years, right? Satya Nadella at Microsoft had a really great quote in April when he said at the earnings call that they've now seen 2 years of digital transformation happen within 2 months. If you look at how you and I are recording this right now, these are skills that we kind of knew, you know, we knew this was possible, but we would never have pushed ourselves to actually try this. So, you know, COVID's been really great in that all the things that were meant to happen has now happened, right? So now we can almost look at this as a hard reset and look into the future. The future will continue to be one of niche media companies. It will be one of where you as a news consumer could go and find news that you're interested in that is meant for you.
Does that mean the death of, you know, the Straits Times and in Australia, the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, The Australian, and so on?
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of large broadsheets struggle with that just because the entire model was premised upon having expensive journalists who were also very good at what they were doing, but also very expensive infrastructure, like, for example, printing presses, distribution networks. Every single newspaper that gets printed, that gets pushed out the door, that gets into your hand, costs a lot of money to make happen.
All these publications are now online.
Yeah.
So won't they survive as online broadsheets? And when I say that, I mean providing a broad scope of news from celebrity sport to politics to business.
Yeah, and I think the struggle there is in the past 10 years, how quickly have these companies been able to shed off a lot of these fixed assets, you know, as they were chugging along toward digital. So I think, you know, if you look at a number of the media players out here, you see that transition has been slow, because for the longest time, everyone said, oh, look, we're still making a lot of money off our print product. We don't have to invest in digital right now when the CPMs are as low as they are. And, you know, fast forward to where we are now, the ad tech space has changed, whereby, you know, 80%, 90% of all digital ad revenue is now going to Facebook and Google. It is not going to publishers. Publishers have not spent enough time figuring out how to get content into the hands of people who really want them and how to personalize that content for them. All of that has put us on the back foot. I think this is going to be a very difficult space, especially if a digital broadsheet is still in the advertising business.
So that says what you're saying is the traditional publishers were sort of asleep at the wheel while Google and Facebook rushed up behind them and then passed them. And that doesn't mean they're still asleep at the wheel.
Well, I think this is where the problem is. You know, I can only count maybe two or three of these players out there who've taken the time to build up an infrastructure that's based on first-party data, which means that they know who you are as a reader as you come through the website. They know your name, they know your email address, they know what you're interested in. They may even take the extra step to match you up against all publicly available data about you as a person. I think all of that is super important, but you know, the fact is a lot of media companies have not taken the time to build that technology. That is the stuff that has allowed Facebook and Google to thrive in a space like this, because they invested in figuring out who people were and what they wanted.
Are you aware of the ACCC investigation into digital platforms in Australia?
Yeah.
Where there is a plan to require Facebook and Google to pay the big publishers for their stories. What do you think of that?
I think that the premise of this was flawed to begin with. This is something that I've been looking at with great alarm and concern, just because I think that this is the kind of action that could affect how other governments look at tech platforms. You know, but in a nutshell, I think that this is an innovation tax that is put on large media, large technology companies, to service and to protect legacy media companies that haven't evolved in this space. And I think that's very dangerous. I think what's important to note here is that with regard to the ACCC, you know, who are they really protecting? Because they're not trying to protect consumer rights here. They're not protecting your right as a news consumer to be able to get news for free or cheaply, because, you know, that's exactly what Facebook and Google do. They allow people anywhere to get access to news and information that wouldn't otherwise be accessible to them. So I think this is an important thing to keep in mind. If the ACCC were to live up to its acronym, it needs to really think about what the impact is on the average consumer, right? That's who you want to defend, not the large legacy zombie media companies that are out there. So to me, this is ludicrous. I think it's a terrible way to try to solve a problem that has already passed. This might have been a conversation 10 years ago, but now that we've all formed new media habits and we have different expectations of our platforms, that ship has long sailed.
So what are you doing at Splice Media that traditional publishers aren't doing? How are you different?
Oh, so for us, we've always been niche. We are a B2B player. For us, our goal is to help media startups thrive and survive in a space like this. So we provide consultancy services. We write about them. We have events that celebrate them. So for us, you know, the one thing that I find incredibly exciting about digital is that we are able to create something like Splice almost from scratch with very low costs. and in many cases for free, you know, to serve an audience that we know and we understand. This is a niche kind of play that I've been talking about, right? Where a small player like us is able to find a community and serve that community.
So who are you competing? You're competing, well, in part, you're competing with the business pages, but it's more than that because you're doing other things. You said events.
Yep. But
you're providing a broader service to your niche community. Do you see that as the way of the future, do you?
Yeah, I think, you know, at the end of the day, and this is maybe one of the bigger shifts as well in this transition to digital. We now are forced to think as product people. We are forced to think, what does this product do and who is it for? What problem does it solve for them, right? So, and this is the beauty of being a small niche player, because it's easy for us to understand what someone expects of us, right? What our users expect of us. It makes it easier in that sense. And yeah, and so we've been transitioning into all these different categories that everyone else is in right now. So if you're a B2B player, there's a very good chance you know, as of this year, you figured out how to do live events at scale. If you are in this space, you would have figured out how to create a newsletter, for example, that is highly engaging, that someone wants to read. So all of these things have kind of happened, you know, in the past year or so. And that's really exciting because I think large media companies don't have the time to think about these things. And very often, you know, if you were a top executive at one of these companies, you would say, does that really move the needle? You know, it takes a lot to move something by 5%, you know, in a large company. Whereas for a small little niche media startup, you're able to jump on new ideas really quickly and test them out, you know, quickly as well.
Does that mean the expectation, your expectation of your audience is that they'll come to you for what you provide, go somewhere else for celebrity gossip, go somewhere else for sport, and go somewhere else for news of the day and somewhere else for politics?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that is something we all need to reconsider, because I really do wonder whether people bought the newspaper wanting all of these sections. As many of us know, a lot of these sections in traditional newspapers existed because there were advertisers who were willing to, you know, to fund them. So entertainment, for example, or lifestyle or cruises or chalets or, you know, whatever it was, right? Those were all advertiser backed. And then of course you had the sports pages. You know, sometimes people would buy the whole newspaper just to get the sports page. So that big bundle type of production doesn't exist on the internet just because you and I have a lot more variety that's out there for every kind of niche category, any niche interest that you and I have. We do not need to buy one big product to get, you know, that one thing that we want.
So how are today's teenagers going to be approaching media when they are in their 20s and 30s?
I like that question. I think this fascinates me because I've got two young kids. My daughter, when she was 4 years old, said to me, "Why are you buying this newspaper? This is yesterday's news." And she said that when she was four. And this, by the way, was the Wall Street Journal. That was my last print subscription that I had. And I miss it because, you know, I did enjoy that routine, but she's absolutely right. Throughout the course of the day, someone like her, someone like you, would stumble on news anyway, just because we are online. You know, we get these notifications on our phones. We live in this real-time news cycle, which is no longer a 24-hour news cycle. So she got that at four. And now here she is at 10, and only maybe 6 months ago when Black Lives Matter was an issue, she learned about Black Lives Matter on Roblox, which is a game that a lot of young kids play. It's a virtual space game. Well, not space in that sense, space as in, you know, it's a virtual realm that you wander. She came across people who were carrying, you know, BLM placards and BLM t-shirts, and she asked, you know, what's this about? And so that was a great way to get into a conversation about something that was very important to all of us.
Where do journalists fit in the way you're looking at the future?
Well, I think what's really also interesting is just kind of watching my kids again. Anytime they have a question about something, if I'm around, they'll ask me, or they'll ask my wife. But they would also ask Google, right? So we have smart devices at home. It's just as easy for them to ask me or to ask Google. Hey Google, what is this about? Or hey Google, what's the capital of this country, for example, right? How many people live in that country? That kind of information is accessible to them in a way that you and I never quite had at our fingertips, right? The ability to call up information as quickly as they can is spectacular. So I think that's the one thing that we need to be aware of in media. Very often we would default to the article, we would default to the broadcast as a way of communicating a piece of information, a bit of knowledge. We also need to really expect a younger generation to be able to call this up, by voice, by asking very, very specific questions. Like, for example, was the US elections disputed? What were the issues of dispute around the election? And to be able to get a good answer from that, I think is really on us to figure out how to create that kind of an experience. But I think that's where we're headed with them.
Well, the other factor is the role of influencers now, and their invasion of journalists, what has been traditionally journalists' space. How do you see that?
Yeah, I think this is something that means a lot to me, because I think that is something that we don't we haven't figured out enough. I remember what it was like, 10 years ago when YouTube was starting to be a thing, and we had these people called YouTubers. And us journalists were looking at them and going, yeah, they may know their domain, but hey, they're not journalists, not with a capital J like we are. And I think a lot of that has lingered on in terms of almost resentment. We resenting them for having the millions in audiences that we don't have, or the revenue that we don't have either, right?
Well, what journalists bring a set of rules
Exactly.
to their craft that hopefully ensures accuracy
Yeah.
and reputation. What influencers have is an ability to build a community.
That's right.
I wonder if the journalist in 10 years' time isn't going to be measured not just by the skill he or she has in gathering and sifting information to present in a way to an audience, but also having an ability to build a community.
That's right, and we've seen this in the past, maybe 2 months now. You may have seen that Casey Newton, who used to write at The Verge, has gone off to start something on his own on Substack. And I think that kind of a trend is really important as well, because you now have a big brand name, recognizable byline, a person who has a lot of authority in this space, going off and starting something on his own, right? As an independent, that is also a trend that's fast emerging, just because the ability for you as an as a known journalist to go out and start something on your own, that is now possible. That wasn't available, maybe 5 years ago, even.
So a journalist's salary might be judged, or their income, potential income, mightn't just be judged on their ability to understand the political machinations in Canberra, but the fact that they've got 167,000 followers.
Yeah, that's right. So there's that as well. I think a lot of this stuff, especially in the field of politics, takes a lot more effort, just because politics is very much an insider's game. For everything else, you kind of have those domains now taken up by influencers.
So, what does this do to trust in journalism, do you think? What are the challenges in the next 10 or 15 years?
I think it's important that we embrace the fact that a younger generation isn't going to look at the mastheads that we look at and go, oh yeah, that's a trustworthy media, right? I don't think the word trust is going to feature as much as it does for our generation of media professionals. I think for them, it's going to be, so when they're watching influencers on YouTube or on TikTok or wherever, those people are people they trust anyway, just because social media is such a personal platform. So that trust is implicit in that relationship between an influencer and his or her audience. So those questions are not being asked the same way as we are now, right? I don't think my kids would grow up expecting or knowing how to identify a credible brand when it comes to media. Sure, like, you know, now they do understand, you know, something like the New York Times or CNN or Al Jazeera, but the relationship is very different. When you have an influencer that you look up to, it is a personal relationship that's built in trust already.
So what impact is this going to have on current journalists, do you think?
Well, I think if you look at where we are with COVID this year and where, you know, where things could go next year, you see already, you know, the number of jobs that have been lost in media this year. Large media companies, newspapers especially, have not been able to keep up with or adjust fast enough with the collapse in advertising. And so with that, we've seen a lot of journalists being out of work. What's going to happen is that in the next 2 years or so, I think it's already started now, you'll see a lot of newly laid off journalists looking for ways to start something on their own, because now probably more than ever, we have all the tools that are available for us to create a media company from scratch. And in many cases also, you're able to start something from scratch for free or almost for free. The tools that you need to get online to build a brand and to build a presence is free. So you're going to see a lot of experimentation that's coming up this year and next year. I think the onus is on us as media ecosystem players to create those opportunities for anyone who's making that jump over into independent journalism, so that they have access to the right tools, they have access to the right funding, they have access to the right networks that can take them forward.
Alan Soon, thank you very much.
Thank you.